were taken and sent to the offender. Basically, it was like the offender had their hooks into the individual.
That's one of the things that makes criminal investigative analysis work, is that people's behaviors leak out information about them and actually create situations in which they're actually taking more risks than they actually think.
The bread and butter for evidence recovery of law enforcement is the ability to track an image, an email, a text back to its sender. And Tor is specifically designed to defeat that ability.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is your host, Jim Clementi, with my co-host, Francie Hakes. How you doing, Francie?
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Good. Well, today we have a mutual friend of ours on, Nick Savage. How you doing, Nick?
I'm doing well. It's good to talk with both of you.
That's great. Well, Nick, tell us where you work and how long and what kind of cases you work.
So I've been with the FBI now almost 18 years, been in law enforcement for over 24. I'm currently assigned to the Washington field office, but the majority of my experience has been within cyber, which has kind of encompassed a lot of different things, to include the early days when all things related to children fell under cyber, all the way through cyber crim, cyber national security, and now I do a lot of work related to the forensic side of the house.
And before you were with the FBI, what did you do?
I was a copper with the city of Pittsburgh, so I was a police officer in the city for about 6.5 years.
That's great. I lived in Pittsburgh for about 6 months. I did a short stint, well, while I was in law school and in the family court system out there.
I'm certainly a little biased, but I think it's the best city in the world.
Well, actually, that year that I was there, and I think it was 1983 or 4, Pittsburgh was named the best city to live in the United States of America.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just definitely it's a big town, very quaint, awesome people, and certainly a place that will forever live in my heart. So always love when I get a chance to go back home.
So where are you right now?
I am currently in Phoenix, Arizona.
Is this for work or for pleasure?
It's for work. I'm at a cyber conference. I just did a keynote address a little earlier this morning, and I also have the pleasure. They've asked me if I would be willing to do the closing keynote as well. So tomorrow evening, that's what I will be doing.
Well, that's really great, and we really appreciate you taking time away from your schedule to talk to us about your best case and your worst case. So why don't we jump right in? Let's start with your best case. What kind of crime would it be?
Hey, Jim, I'd have to say probably the best case I ever worked was a 4.5 year investigation. It was really the first time in the child exploitation side of things where the hacker world kind of intersected with child exploitation. So it was an investigation where individuals, and it wasn't determined that it was more than one until later, but we had a situation where somebody had hacked into a young girl's computer and essentially extorted her into producing images of child pornography. And up until that point, you know, we'd often talked about the day on which something like this would occur, but this is really the first time, I believe, in the FBI where it actually happened.
Wow, so that sounds pretty serious, that a hacker, or more than one hacker, hacked into children's computers and actually coerced them into producing child pornography.
Correct.
Wow.
Now, Nick, if I remember correctly, the beginnings of this case, I think the thing that would really interest our listeners has to do with how this case came to law enforcement attention, because I think that's one of the more remarkable things. I don't want to give it away, spoiler alert for later, but that's one of the more remarkable things about this case is the number of victims, which we'll describe later. But how did the first child come to law enforcement attention?
You know, it started with a 15-year-old girl. And, you know, it's one of these things where, in hindsight, we saw a lot of different things. And I think for the longest time in the Bureau, or at least maybe in law enforcement, we often assume that in order to be a victim, you had to come from a broken home. There had to be some problems. There had to be some issues that were underlying that would have related to potentially, you know, a young child being victimized. And in this particular situation, it happened to be a 15-year-old girl in a really nice environment, beautiful home, loving mom and dad, very religious, church-going folks. And it just so happened that the young girl, in the course of being exploited, her young sister happened to walk in while she was taking pictures of herself. And that was kind of the beginning where the parents contacted law enforcement. And in the beginning, they contacted state and local law enforcement, who unfortunately, and again, this was a very different time, they were unable to do anything due to some of the IP addresses coming back to overseas. At that time, it was much more difficult to kind of work these sorts of cases. So when local law enforcement first heard about this, they essentially told the family there's nothing that they could do.
Wow. And earlier you were talking about the fact that mostly you anticipated that these things only happen to sort of poor families or families with issues, because mainly offenders are looking for kids with vulnerabilities, right?
Correct. Correct.
And here, what area of the country was this child, Nick? Do you recall?
Yeah, so this was in Middle District of Florida. It was in the Orlando area where I was stationed at the time that this had happened. I just remember happening to get the call, and the family asked us to come over. And as I was driving over with another one of my folks that was on the task force, the victim's mother called and said, would it be okay if another family came over, that there was another girl that this had happened to? And that was really kind of the beginning that led us to believe that this was just not an isolated event. This was something that was a little larger in scale.
And can you talk just briefly, Nick, about, you said that he had hacked into her computer and coerced her into self-producing sexual images of herself. Can you explain how that worked? Like, what did the offender use to coerce the child? I mean, I think that's something really significant for parents to understand how these offenders operate and how it is they coerce the children. Because I think most parents believe, well, if someone, you know, just hacked into my child's computer and said, send me a naked picture, my kid would never do it. So how did that work?
So in this particular case, the individual or individuals, what they would do was, once they gain access to a computer, they would generally go through the individual's pictures to see if there was anything there that potentially could be embarrassing. And oftentimes that was the start. But if not, the individuals had the ability to turn on web cameras, other devices, and then essentially spy on the kids. And then they were able to get the kids in various states of dress, getting in and out of the shower. And that sometimes was the beginning of the exploitation. And the exploitation, you know, at first it was, I wouldn't call it subtle, but it was essentially, hey, I would like you to take five pictures. It was always five pictures. Just take five pictures for me, and I promise I'll leave you alone. And a surprise to none of us, as soon as those images, you know, were taken and sent to the offender, basically it was like the offender had their hooks into the individual. And then it turned out to be, I want five more. I need them to be more graphic. I want you doing this. Because if you don't, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to distribute those images to all your friends, all your family, because I have access to your computer.
Okay.
I know who all your friends and family are.
Okay, so here we have a guy who is able to, while the kids are off their computer, while they're just going about their lives, bathing, getting dressed in the morning, getting ready for bed at night, turn on their computer and take pictures of them or take videos of them while they're in various states of undress. Is that what's going on?
Absolutely.
And then once they have that, quote, embarrassing data from them, then they get a little more aggressive. And they're saying, I want to take five pictures, and I promise after you take those five pictures, you'll never hear from me again. Of course, that's the hook that they never get away from, right?
Jim, you're absolutely correct.
So this then leads into what? A series of back and forth, well, I want five more, I want five more. What goes on?
Yeah, it's kind of the extent of it where, you know, the individual just demanded more and more graphic images. And then, you know, every once in a while, you know, the victims in this case would finally get up enough courage to stop or to essentially threaten the offender by either telling somebody, going to law enforcement. And the reaction, it didn't scare these individuals off. I mean, what it ended up doing was simply angering them. And it was interesting because there was a case out of Pennsylvania where a teenager was charged with manufacturing child pornography. A teenager had taken images and was charged, surprisingly enough. And that actually made national news. First, there was an article in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and then there was an article in USA Today. And one of the things that these individuals would do would say, go ahead, call law enforcement. And then they would say, but I'm not going to get in trouble for this. You are. And then they would share the image or they would share a link with the news reporting showing where teenagers had been charged for manufacturing child pornography. So the threat was, if you report this, I'm not going to get in trouble. You are, and you'll be arrested. That was one thing. The other thing, and it happened in a couple cases where the offenders created web pages using the images of child pornography and then distributed those to family members and other members of victims, schoolmates, classmates, to basically just say, look, if you don't continue producing, I'm going to continue sharing all of these with everyone.
So they actually did share them? I mean, didn't things come crashing down after that?
No, surprisingly, it didn't. You know, the individuals who were doing this felt relatively confident that they would never be caught.
Because they used anonymizers?
I think part of it was the individual that we later identified who was overseas just thought there was no way that we would, A, identify him, and B, be interested enough to go over and get him.
But,
and, you know, even parents, when they would communicate with these guys online, would just basically be frustrated because the offenders would say, you know, go ahead, you'll never catch us.
Wow. But tell us what technology they used. Were they on Tor? Were they using anonymizers? What was going on?
No, this is kind of before Tor. They were using Beast and Poison Ivy and various other RAT, remote access tools to gain access to kids' computers. And this is kind of the early days of hacking where it was very difficult to track your way back in order to get to these individuals. And I think during the early times of this investigation, I think I was giving sometimes too much credit to the offenders, thinking that, you know, it had to be more complicated. And when we identified an individual living in North Carolina, I incorrectly assumed that he had to be a victim and that we thought that maybe he had been a hack victim and somebody was using him as a proxy to go through him and back to the victims that we had in Florida. And the reason I say that was because, unbeknownst to us at the time, the offenders were using keystroke loggers. So even when they weren't watching kids, they were essentially capturing the chats from these kids. And then what they would do is, in the course of conversing with these victims, they would use things that they learned during those chats. They would comment about some event that happened in school or something that they wore. When the offenders would talk to the kids, because there was a lot of chatting during the extortion, it almost made it seem as though the offender was close to the victim, that it was somebody within proximity that had access to the kid. And it was done for a couple reasons. It was done to make the victims more afraid, but it was also done to mask where the location of the offenders were. And for the longest time, we thought we were looking for somebody in Florida around the majority of our initial victims.
So you've got offenders that are smart, arrogant, sadistic. And can you describe a little bit why, when you identified someone in North Carolina, why you thought they were a hack victim versus the offender?
Well,
and what was his name?
That individual's name was Ivory Dickerson.
Right.
And we thought for the longest time that he had just been a victim of this. He was an engineer. He happened to be a black male. You know, the majority of individuals who engage in this criminal activity generally tend to be white males. So he didn't fit somebody that we thought potentially could be engaged in this activity. So, you know, it was kind of like all those things. When we identified him, we actually drove up and we interviewed him and asked him for his help, which in hindsight, the things he said and done made perfect sense. But at the time, we just thought he was an uncooperating victim.
Right. What led you then to the idea that he was actually an offender?
Well, before we get there, I want to go back. You talked about RAT, remote access tools, and Tor. Could you explain to our listeners what those things are?
So essentially, it was a program that gave somebody outside access to a particular system through a remote access. So what would happen was the individuals would send something to these victims. And within whatever they would send, whether it be a picture or send something to them, within it was a virus. And once you clicked on that image or that file, it installed that program. And then what would happen was, once it was installed on someone's system, it would call out. It would call back to a particular IP address to essentially alert the offenders that this victim was online. And once they were kind of online, then the offenders would remote into the victim's computers, and they would do a couple things. One, sometimes they would just sit and watch and listen, or they would turn on the web camera. But then every once in a while, too, to demonstrate who they were and their control over the victims, they would do things like they would make things pop up. They would instruct the victim to open up WordPad. And once the victim did, the offenders would start typing onto the victim's computers, just to say things like, here I am, I'm your hacker, I'm now in your system, and you're going to do exactly what I tell you to do.
So they were showing their domination.
Yes, and I'll be honest with you, when the first time I actually saw it, I have to admit, it was actually kind of freaky. What we ended up doing was, one of the victims, we were able to assume her identity. And in doing so, I actually used her computer, and every day I would go online pretending to be this victim, doing different things. So I actually got to experience a little bit of what it was like to be one of these kids. And I have to admit, I mean, it was actually kind of frightening the first couple times it happened to me. So I couldn't imagine what it would be like to be a 13, 14, 15-year-old young girl.
And so this was old technology, though. Now, this is ancient technology compared to what's available today. So tell us a little bit about the Tor network and what kind of new technologies that are out there that are even more scary.
You know, a lot of it is. And a lot of it now is designed with anonymity in mind. And certainly, as you mentioned, there's anonymizers, and there are ways in which you can spoof your identity, or you can set up proxies so you can mask where you actually are. It certainly gives the indication that you could A, be somewhere else, or through Tor, it strips off layers. So it makes it virtually impossible to kind of work your way back to a particular individual or put somebody behind a keyboard.
But what is Tor? Can you tell our listeners?
So it's the Onion Router. And there are certain things that you need in order to access the Onion Router. But once you get onto the Onion Router, there are just various things that you can do. And a lot of criminal activity takes place with individuals using that router to, again, kind of anonymize their location and their activity.
Well, the Onion Router, how does that make sense? It's cut an onion in half and you see all the different layers. Is that sort of a metaphor for the different layers of an onion, deeper and deeper?
It is. And what happens is, anytime you are in cyberspace, it bounces around at the speed of light. So it's always fun to kind of trace where you're going around the world. And essentially, your activity or your transmission, it hops. It hops through the various servers and routers around the world. So if you have the ability to kind of mask that activity or to strip it off, it's hard to find your way back from the endpoint. You know, a lot of times if you get an email from somebody, you can turn the header on and you can see all the IP addresses where it kind of touched in between whoever sent it and your destination. If you have the ability to strip all that off, then it's kind of like it hides people's movements and behaviors.
So Tor basically is a tool that wasn't available to these guys back then, but it's available now, and it actually makes it much more difficult for law enforcement to trace back where somebody is committing these crimes from, right?
It makes it very difficult.
I mean,
absolutely.
It's deliberately made for that purpose. Tor exists to try to end run somebody reverse engineering back to who is actually the source of particular information.
Correct. product. I mean, it was initially created by the military, so it was an original DOD product in furtherance of national security that has now eventually been used for criminal purposes.
Well, and Nick, you know, you and I have both worked a lot of cyber cases, and the sort of the bread and butter, if you talk about child pornography cases, for example, or enticing cases, the bread and butter for evidence recovery of law enforcement is the ability to track an image, an email, a text back to its sender. And Tor is specifically designed to defeat that ability, right?
It is. It is. I mean, and it's just one of several ways in which people now try to hide their behavior. But in the end, you know, a lot of these individuals, you can't be too clean. You can't be too perfect. I mean, there are always nuggets and artifacts. And in the end, and Jim, I think you'll appreciate this, and certainly I think your listeners will as well, is you can't change people's behaviors. I mean, we're all creatures of habit. And the things that people do, that's kind of what makes them sloppy. They're somewhat predictable. So you can do all these things to mask your identity, but your behavior, it's really difficult to change. I mean, it's just something that naturally occurs. And really, it's what people do in the end that often trip them up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that makes criminal investigative analysis work, is that people's behaviors leak out information about them and actually create situations in which they're actually taking more risks than they actually think, because they reveal things just through their behaviors.
Well, I was just going to say, too, and on the child side of this, rationality does not come into play when it comes to these sorts of behaviors. You know, intelligence has nothing to do with the way people act, and their need-driven behaviors. People who are attracted to these kids are willing to take chances. They're willing to be sloppy sometimes because their need overrides all other sense of rationality. Those are things people very rarely can control, and those are things that are going to leave those little nuggets and clues behind.
Yeah, and we add to that need and desire-driven behavior, because these are things they want to do. These are things that are very important to them, and a lot of times they'll put blinders on, not see what they're actually risking by doing it.
Best Case, Worst Case is brought to you by Rockstar Games and L.A. Noire, the dark detective crime thriller set among the violence, glamour, and corruption of 1940s Los Angeles. Out now for Nintendo Switch, Xbox One, and PS4, L.A. Noire allows you to scour crime scenes, pick up and examine objects, interrogate witnesses, and determine who is telling the truth or lying to cover up a brutal murder. Solve crimes inspired by real cases from one of L.A.'s most violent decades. L.A. Noire from Rockstar Games, out now. Rated M for mature. Order now at rockstargames.com/L.A. Noire.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
So the next thing we want to talk about, Nick, is how you eventually identified the offenders and all the victims that they subjected themselves to.
Yeah, I understand this case really blew up big time.
You know, after we at the Ivory Dickerson's house and we started to talk with him, he didn't want to cooperate, which again, you know, it makes more sense now, but at the time it just didn't make sense. And it just, there was something odd about the entire time that we were with him asking for his cooperation and his help. And after our visit to him, things kind of really cooled off for about a 6-month period with respect to the offenders reaching out to these kids. And it was almost 6 months to the day of our visit to Ivory Dickerson that the criminal activity started to occur and the kids were being recontacted and extorted for more images. What we ended up doing was kind of set up a couple things. We set up a pen register. So we were actually monitoring Ivory Dickerson's criminal activity at the same time that we were using the undercover technique of assuming the identity of one of our victims. And through monitoring his traffic, it became abundantly clear when our victims' computers were calling out to an IP address, we were seeing that Ivory Dickerson was actually making a connection with this IP address. And what we were able to show was that there was no connection coming in before it, indicating or at least telling us that he had to have been the one
initiating,
who was in direct contact with the victim in this case and that it wasn't somebody going through him.
Yeah.
So you were using technology against the hackers. I love the irony of that.
Absolutely. You said that you had originally thought of him as a potential victim, that he was being extorted, but he wasn't cooperative. How did he respond when you came knocking on his door?
Yeah, it was interesting because I was sitting there talking to him. Essentially, I told him so much about the case. I told him about these young girls that were being victimized and terrorized and how they were afraid. I mean, literally terrified. These kids were afraid to leave the house after being threatened. And I remember him saying that, leaning back, and he asked if he could go get a drink. And I remember he made a drink, and he was sitting on the couch, and he laid his head back, and he said, "Whoa, this is really heavy, man. I can't believe this." And I kept saying, "But I need your help, Ivory. I need your help." And he kept saying, "Nah, I can't help it." And I finally said, "Why? I mean, why won't you help us?" And he said it was a cultural thing. And according to him, he said, "Look, I grew up on the wrong side of the tracks." And he said, "I don't have the best relationship with law enforcement." And then he said, "If you can't get beyond me, you'll blame me for this." And I remember saying to him, "Yes, but it's not you. You're a victim in the case. There's no reason for me not to be able to get beyond you. If you let me do some consensual monitoring of your computer, I can get back to whoever's doing this." And he said, "If you can't, you'll blame me." And that statement stuck with me for a really long time.
How old was he at the time?
He was in his probably mid-30s.
So what I'm interested in is the other offender who, spoiler alert for our listeners, I had a tiny piece of involvement in this case, so I'm familiar with the facts. So once you did the pen register and you were adopting the identity of one of the victims, were you able to trace that computer activity that was running through Ivory Dickerson's computer to another offender?
What we were able to see was whenever our victim's computer was calling out to an IP address, every once in a while, it would connect to a foreign IP address. And those IP addresses resolved in the UK, they resolved in Thailand and Saudi Arabia, which I just thought was odd. And I thought at the time, we thought that maybe Ivory Dickerson somehow, again, had been going through either victims in that area or some sort of a proxy in order to mask his behavior. And it wasn't later until we started to realize or think that it could be another individual. And I can get more specific about that. It wasn't until after the arrest of Ivory Dickerson when the mother of one of the victims called me and said, whoever this is, it's still going on.
Wow. So that was really the first moment that you knew you had multiple offenders, was after you arrested Ivory Dickerson and somebody was still extorting a child.
Francie, I remember that phone call like it was yesterday, because after we made the arrest of Ivory Dickerson, he was detained and he was in the process of being brought down to Orlando from North Carolina. So in the back of my mind, I thought this was over and all criminal activity had ceased. So when that mother called me and said that the criminal activity was still occurring, it was only the second time in my life that my life actually flashed before my eyes, because
gut punched
I was
you?
Processing so much. Oh, without a doubt. Because for one brief second, I thought to myself, did I have the wrong guy? Was there a possibility that I could have arrested somebody that wasn't responsible for this? And that really began kind of phase two of this investigation, where we ended up like, it was almost like two separate investigations to kind of get back to this individual, because it wasn't too far removed from 9/11. So trying to get information from various partners overseas wasn't exactly easy to do on the criminal side of the house.
Yeah, I remember that time very well. And just for our listeners' edification, after 9/11, the FBI really pulled back from criminal investigations and focused its attention almost completely on counterterrorism. And that hurt a lot. It hurt a lot of different jurisdictions that we actually helped out, and a lot of victims that were just hanging out there because the FBI, rightly so, had to take the lead role in this counterterrorism investigation that followed 9/11. But I think the ripple effects were felt many, many years after 9/11 on the criminal side.
That's absolutely the case. And so, Nick, you guys now start phase two. And so that we don't run out of time, I do want our listeners to hear the story of how difficult it actually was for you to physically secure the other offender. So let's skip ahead to you've identified him. And tell everybody where he was and how you had to jump through so many hoops in order to actually get your hands on him.
Well, after having chased him through the United Kingdom and Thailand and Saudi Arabia, by then I knew who he was. And through the course of the digital analysis of Ivory Dickerson's machines and hard drives, and, you know, I was able to begin to identify a number of these victims. And one of the victims that I happened to identify, who lived in Canada, actually knew Patrick Conley by name. And she was my first victim who could identify him and actually spoke to him on the phone. And just to give you a little bit of the mindset of Patrick Conley, he hacked this girl as Patrick Conley. And then what he did was, when he was extorting her, he actually reached out to her as himself, and he said, hey, I'm really good at this. I just want to let you know I can make that individual go away. There's things that I can do to your computer to help you. And this young victim willingly agreed to let the real Patrick Conley do this. And at the same time, Patrick Conley hacked her a third time, and basically then turned up the heat and just did some really nasty, ugly things to this young girl.
That's horrible.
Made her do, it was horrible what he made her do. And then what happened was, this victim would actually call Conley up crying and begging and pleading that this other individual, this other hacker, had been doing this. So at the same time he was extorting and exploiting her, he was actually listening to her cry to him about what this guy was making her do.
Victimizing her again and again and again. And tell us,
yes,
Nick, how many victims did you ultimately uncover in this case?
3,880.
Wait, what?
3,880 victims that were worldwide.
Wow. And what continents was that on?
Probably with the exception of Antarctica, all the rest.
Wow. Wow.
Incredible.
There were victims everywhere.
And how many in the United States?
Several thousand.
So these two guys How did they know each other? How did they get in touch with each other?
They met in an undercover hacker forum in the early days, and they just happened to kind of hook up. And interestingly enough, Ivory Dickerson thought Patrick Conley was a female. And Patrick Conley, they thought, had victimized a girl in North Carolina, and he had assumed her identity. And he was pretending to be this girl from North Carolina, and Ivory Dickerson thought that this individual was, in fact, this girl. And Dickerson had falsely thought that this young girl happened to also be into other young girls. But what he didn't know was Patrick Conley was all about control and extortion and humiliation. Ivory Dickerson was a true pedophile. He was definitely into kids, wanted the collection, wanted the images. So definitely quite the dichotomy with respect to their motivations, but both very much interested in children.
So Nick, talk about, you've identified him. Where was he?
So a period of time had gone by. Ivory Dickerson had been sentenced. He received 110 years. Which I was very pleased with that sentence. And at the same time, I did a proffer with Ivory Dickerson, which I thought was interesting.
So that's like a, is that like a debriefing, Nick?
Yes. He was seeking government cooperation by sitting down and telling us about how he committed the crime, some of the things that he may have done, basically trying to help us identify some more of these kids. And during that time, it was interesting. He told us about Patrick Conley. He also said, after we visited him in North Carolina for the first time, he reached out to Patrick Conley and told him that the FBI was sitting in his house. And Patrick Conley's exact words were, "If the FBI wants me, they can come get me." And when I heard that, I thought, you know what? We are going to come get you. It may take a little bit, but I'm going to find you wherever you are. So a period of time had gone by, and after the sentencing, where victims started calling again saying that this individual, who by then I knew was Patrick Conley, had been reaching out to them again and extorting them. And it was one particular victim in New Orleans. She was still a minor, happened to be pregnant at the time. And when Conley reached out and said, "Hey, I want some more images from you, or I'm going to make you the most famous person ever," she basically said, "Look, I'm pregnant. There's no way I'm doing it." Patrick Conley said to her, "I don't care if you're pregnant or not. If you don't send images to me," and then he paused and he said, "You know what I'm capable of doing. You remember the old days." And that was some of the things that he was doing. And Patrick Conley at this time was working as a contractor in Baghdad. And specifically, he was working at Camp Liberty. And because he was on an American military base, even though he was in another country, it was as if he was on American soil. So for the first time of us chasing him around the world, I had him on American soil. And that was the beginning of the end for us being able to get back and lay hands on Patrick Conley.
And so you all had to go through a lot of hoops and a lot of people telling you no, but eventually you had to come up with a ruse to get Patrick Conley to fly back into the States, right?
Yeah, it was interesting because obviously Patrick Conley is a Brit. We were kind of at the height of the Gulf War, and the Brits were an ally. So the Department of Justice and the State Department was very apprehensive about the FBI wanting to go over to Baghdad and actually arrest an individual who was not an American. And as a result, there were certain things that the Department of Justice had required in order for us to be able to effect that arrest. And part of that was that we had to work through Department of State attorneys to be able to seek British government concurrence in order to make sure that things were above board, that they were aware of the investigation and what we were doing. And I wasn't sure if I was even going to be able to get him out of Iraq. And we contacted the Brits, and the Brits said that if he were to be arrested by them, he was only looking at maybe 2 to 4 years.
Wow.
Their sentencing is terrible.
Exactly. Ivory Dickerson had been sentenced to 110 years. He was looking at 2 to 4 years in London or in England, and he was by far...
more culpable.
He was. I mean, he was a despicable human being.
So what'd you decide to do?
One of the things was, well, they were talking about potentially kicking him off the base, but by that time, Iraq was a sovereign country and said they wouldn't extradite him back to the United States. And we thought about maybe allowing him to go to Thailand, because by then he was married, was soon to have a baby, but Thailand, they said at the time, they would not extradite. So long story short, we ended up coming up with a ruse to get him to the United States, specifically to fly into Atlanta, where we were able to make the arrest.
Wow. And what was the actual ruse?
So he was working for an American firm, and essentially we were looking to have him come back for some training. So we ended up flying literally his entire group of people all kind of came back at the time in order to make the arrest.
Wow. And Nick, if I remember correctly, when he flew into Atlanta, you were forced to deal with the duty assistant U.S. attorney there in Atlanta. What was she like?
Oh, I remember her quite well.
Really?
She was, I have to admit,
tell
she
me
did
more.
An outstanding job.
Oh.
I paid
she
him to
amazing.
Say that. That's how Nick and I met, actually.
I assume that it was our own Francie Hakes.
The world famous.
Yes.
The one and only.
And so you were able to arrest him and indict him and federally. And what was the outcome of the case?
Well, two things if I can share with you just to kind of show you the mindset of Conley. So at the time that we arrested him, you know, I needed him to talk because a lot of the evidence that we had was circumstantial. It was difficult to put him behind a keyboard because Camp Liberty at the time had internet cafes that piped in IP addresses into a cafe where, you know, any number of individuals could use those things. So I needed to kind of get him to talk. And one of the things that I thought was interesting when I finally got him to admit certain things, I asked him specifically about the victim in New Orleans, the minor that happened to be pregnant. I remember him saying to me, he referred to her as a slut. And he said specifically that the FBI should be investigating her for all the things she has done, including the manufacturing child pornography that she sent to him, which I thought was interesting. I've never worked anybody like him. The other thing I thought was interesting.
We call that projection, by the way.
Yeah.
Projecting the blame on a victim. But go ahead.
Yes.
What was the other thing interesting about him?
The other thing that was interesting was when we were going through the digital evidence, we came across images of his wife, which I thought was interesting. And at the time, I saw pictures of them. He was celebrating her 16th birthday party with her family. And
what? Wait, what?
I don't know many people. Yeah. As an adult, he was celebrating her 16th birthday party. And there were all these images. But then in addition to that, I saw all these other images, what looked like her being exploited, much like all these other victims, which was just strange to me. And it wasn't until he made a phone call back home where he was talking to her on the phone and she wanted to know why he was arrested. And he said, do you remember when that individual hacked your computer and made you do all of those things?
Oh, my God.
He said, that's what they're accusing me of doing. And that shows you his mindset.
So he actually became the White Knight hero to her, and she ended up marrying him, not knowing that he was the one that had done all that stuff to her before?
Correct.
Oh my God.
That's unbelievable.
And how old was she at the time that you discovered this?
I have no idea because, unfortunately, we've never been able to interview her about her own victimization. But, you know, unfortunately, we have all the proof of that crime.
Wow. That's just another level of disgusting depravity. Oh, my God.
Talk about malevolence. I mean, yeah. That's true malevolence.
Well, cheers to you for actually getting him and locking him up. How long was he sentenced for?
He was sentenced to a statutory max, 30 years. And then after the 30 years, he will be deported out of the United States.
Well, at least he's out of commission for 30 years, but I hope that you put together all that information and send it to the UK and let them know that in how many years will it be now? that he gets out?
It's about 20 now, right, Nick?
Yeah, about 22 more years.
Okay, so in 22 years, you should let them know that in 22 years, he'll be coming back to them, and hopefully they can file a case now and hold, because I know, like, statute of limitations gets told, right? If he's arrested
somewhere else. Well, it does
here.
I don't know.
If he's out of the jurisdiction.
I don't know what the Brits do with statute
of limitations. But at the very least, you can maybe get him for a few more years over there when he comes back, and you should at least let the wife know that she was actually the victim of this crime. Maybe they'll, if you can send it to Scotland Yard or Interpol, they'll talk to her and she might file charges against him in the interim.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if there's any sort of an equivalent to a civil commitment in any of these countries, but if anybody needs to be civilly committed, it is in fact Patrick Connolly.
Well, and Nick, I think my last question for you really is, this is just a terrible case example in the sense of so many victims, so much evil, malevolence, collaboration among offenders, hacking, all of which is very frightening. What made this your best case?
Honestly, I think it was the perseverance. It wasn't until later when I talked to so many of these victims that I had learned that they had reached out to law enforcement and that nobody was able to help or do anything. I remember there was one particular girl in the Orlando area. I came across her images, and the only reason I knew at the time that she was in Florida was because she was at a car wash. It was some fundraiser where they were washing cars. I think she was like maybe 14 at the time. So I knew that she was a local victim, and I literally spent years looking for this kid. And it wasn't until after, when Patrick Connolly had started to recontact people from Baghdad, he reached out to her. And I was able to identify her. And I will never forget this as long as I live. I remember when I knocked on her door, and this tiny little young woman, because she was an adult at the time, answered the door. And when I identified who I was, she just started to cry. And she said to me, "I have been waiting for you to come for years now."
Wow.
I just got chills.
And I will never, never forget that.
Well, that totally explains it. And you should be commended for not only the successful law enforcement operation, but for representing all those thousands of victims around the world, not just in the small little neighborhood, but around the world. We thank you. And our listeners thank you.
Jim and Francis, first of all, let me thank you for doing this, because part of why I like to talk about this case, it's not about what we did. It's about letting these young women know, who are now all adults, that whoever did this to them, because we couldn't identify all of them, that these individuals are now being held responsible for their activity. And then I have those images, that they don't have to look behind them in the past anymore, that we know who they are, they're paying the price, and they did never have to worry about being victimized anymore.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your best case with us. It was definitely a good best case.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll have to get back to you soon about talking about your worst case. So we'll be back in contact with you about that. And thank you for being with us on Best Case, Worst Case.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Terrell Parham. Music by Simba Sumba. And hosted by Wondery.
You can subscribe to Best Case, Worst Case on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, or your favorite listening app.
This episode was also edited by Mike Thal.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness to Light can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D2L.org.